Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Parmenides. I can pronounce him now. He's a Greek philosopher. I'm reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And this is probably episode 3. Episode 1, introducing his life. Episode 2, chundering through, working through his poem. Episode 4 is a bit of a slow up, where I remember talking very much about Bertrand Russell and the negative existentialism. That is, if you can think of something that's not there, it's therefore there, because it's the actual thought is there. And that's been wrapped up with groups, group theory, and with set theory, mathematics nowadays. That's not such a problem. And the other thing I discussed is what monoism is. Now, it sort of really doesn't quite make sense nowadays, but a dualist view is body and mind and matter, or spirits and the actual physical world. The dualist view, a monist view, is everything's together. And the monist comes along with the Platonic view of forms. It goes along this way. And the monist has sort of been a subcurrent up to modern philosophy. And that's sort of led to its a mathematical of digital, a digital age is the monist. And we're now just to clue into who Parmenides is. Parmenides, I can say it now. And so yesterday I tried to recall the name, because I didn't have the pronunciation right, it sort of caused a brain jam. I couldn't actually remember his name, Parmenides. But he's a Greek around 512 BC, sort of early, just after the time of Pythagoras. But he had a very similar role. So there's these, if you'd like, housing estates, new Greek developments in the ancient world, where you could, if you're sick and tired of the raiding and the life on the Greek peninsula, you can trade across and settle in Italy, which wasn't necessarily Italy at that stage. It was just wild tribes in the hills. You could settle there, have a bit of a Greek life, and what it meant is that the Greek civilization is on the cusp. So what would happen is the Greek ships would dump you there, then the Greek ships would disappear. So you'd be Greek, but it would be like a petri dish of evolution. So you had these philosophies coming up. So you had Pythagoras, who's in one Greek colony, another further down in Sicily. But this is up around Brindisi. There's a city called Ella. It's now got a modern name. I've forgotten what it's called. I'll have to have a look at it. And this person here wrote a poem. Now, you have to really understand that religion was the repository of philosophy, and religion was a thing which was open to interpretation. There's no central church, for instance. There was a high priestess, but or priest. They performed ceremonies, but they never, it wasn't a written down, controlled thing. It was a more oral tradition with non-centralized doctrine sort of coming along the place. So I don't think you could ever be burnt as a heretic in ancient times. I suppose you could have been. But it sort of meant that these religious ideas and philosophies put together. Again, there was no journals. So this person wrote a very long, long poem, which has been lost, but we've got different fragments of it. Fragments have been numbered, and they're putting the fragments together. There are certain blanks in the fragments that no matter how hard you try, you can't see. And they're lacunes, L-A-C-U-N. This is blank areas where people speculate. Working across now, people are trying to work out what this person said. And it's very important in a zone of philosophy. Even if you don't believe in scholasticism, scholasticism is where you look for ancient texts and see if someone wrote something first, that's like a first discovery, and you can or can vary from it. So it's sort of sort of like a path of where we've been. Now, it's like true archaeology, working back. So a lot of people were concerned about what this person said. Now, he wrote this big poem. We'll go into what the poem was in a little while, but then we know a lot about this because Plato, who wrote his philosophies not in poems but in sort of like movie scripts or dialogues, had him and his follower come along, and they basically had this sort of a mathematical viewpoint, and he had him discussing his philosophy in Greece. So that brings this person really to life, and then we have these other views, people who write commentaries on it, and in order to write a commentary, they write out sections of the script, but this script has actually disappeared. So, now we're on to 3.1. So, section 3 is the various interpretations of this poem. So it's hard to get your mind about, but we are right on the cusp of things coming along. There's not been, philosophers are not established as a profession. A philosopher itself becomes a ruler. So, this is 3.1, the strict monist interpretation. So, monist is the monad. It's written by a dot with a circle in the centre of it. That's the monad. And you get crazy philosophers. Leibniz being a monadist. And he develops from contemplation of the monad calculus and digital maths. So, two very important things for our modern age. And I'll just try and work out what monadism. I think monadism does exist, but in a more complex way nowadays, in terms of science. A good many interpreters have taken the poem's first major phrase as an argument for strict monism, or paradoxically view that there exists exactly one thing, and for this alone entities being totally unchanging and undifferentiated. So that's essentially monadism. Monadism says there's existence, but there's only one thing. And, which is true in a certain sense. If you do field theory, the Bayesian theory is a monadist theory. In this view, Paramenides considers our world, our ordinary experience, non-existence, and our normal beliefs of this existence of change, plurality, and even, it seems, our own selves to be entirely deceptive. Okay, this is a hard thing to go. I mean, you've got to sort of, I suppose this, as you reach the final chapter, you're about to pop off. What's it all about? Well, I'm just a computer program. Sati. Although less common than it once was, this type of view still has its adherents and is probably familiar to many who have only had a superficial acquaintance with Paramenides. Well, that's me. I've only got a superficial acquaintance with him. So this was the major interpretation that he said that there's only one thing. And if you say, look, existence, I can prove that one thing exists, which is everything, and we're all being in the mind of God, you get some crazy conclusion. Okay, so this, the strict monist interpretation is influentially represented in the first two volumes of W.K.C. Guthrie's A History of Greek Philosophy, where it recorded a critical role in the development of early Greek natural philosophy from the purported material monism of the early Milesians to the pluralist physical theories of Empedocles, Anaxagoras, and other atomists. Well, that's exactly what I'm trying to say is our world here, the atomist theory. It's really interesting how these two goes together. So, an atomist is the people who eventually came up with the atomic theory. Lysippus and Democritus. Now, Democritus is what is the one person in the textbooks we go, he's an anatomist, and it's not put in any context in at school. We should say atomic theory began with the Greeks. Democritus had his atomic theory. He believed in atoms. Full stop. On Guthrie's strict monist reading, Paramindi's deduction of nature of reality led him to conclude, quote, the reality is and must be a unity of the strictest sense, and that any change in it is impossible, which is Zeno's paradox. And look, really, you could say, so I don't know about the growth of entropy, and therefore the world as perceived by the senses is unreal. Okay, so Guthrie's 1965, a bit of a guff. Finding reason and sensation to yield wildly contradictory views of reality, Paramindi's presumed reason must be preferred to sensory evidence, thereby rejected altogether deceptive. Now, it's interesting that this same argument is done by the rationalists and Lockean experiments. You know, this argument that's taken 2,000 years to get us scientists up doing experiments. The strict monism, on Guthrie's view, took particular aim at the monoistic material principles of Milesian cosmology. So, you know, this is where you keep on digging back. I don't feel like that many philosophers digging back. So, Paramindi's is someone who really have to. You get Plato, you go, oh God, I have to go back to this person, and now you have to go back to Milesian. So, Milesian, who's I think he is it's a precursor of it, but there's not too many people, so it's not bottomless pit. Okay, this is a quote from Guthrie, and obviously Guthrie, oh, it is from page 15 to 16 of his 1965 Fantastic Roots. Paramindi's argues with devastating precision, that once one has said that something is, one is debarred from saying that it was or will be. For attributing to it an origin or dissolution in time or any alteration or motion whatsoever. But this was just what Milesians have done. They supposed that the world had not always existed in its present cosmic state. They derived it from one substance which they asserted to have changed or moved in various ways, becoming hotter or colder, drier or wetter, rarer or denser, in order to produce the present world order. Well, look, I don't know if these people are really concerned about it, because we've got this CERN supercollider sort of pouring out answers to us. A particular focus of Paramindi's criticism on this view was Anaximander's idea that opposites are initially latent with the originative principle he called the boundless, the apeiron, prior to being separated out from it. If the opposite characteristics existed prior to being separated out, then the boundless was not a true unity. But if they did not exist prior to being separated out, how could they possibly come into existence? And this is really rather interesting, because you see this basic step, people saying, when they were working out, when they saw mass extinctions, they thought, well, this is many years later in the 1780s. I forgot the actual names of the French anatomists who believed that there was God was recreating, had creation was happening again and again. Catastrophist. There was catastrophe, and God had to go in and say, bloody hell, I've got not many animals left here. Oh, bugger, I better produce a few new animals, new inventions. But this seems a bit hard. It is thus illegitimate to, let's say, it's thus illegitimate to suppose that everything came into being out of one thing. In addition to thus criticizing the theoretical viability of the monistic material principles of early Malthusian cosmologists, Parmenides also supposed to have criticized the Malthusian union of the material and moving cause in their principles by arguing that motion and change are impossible and indivisible conceptions, which is Zeno's paradox, you can't do it, which is resolved eventually by calculus. I think is a beautiful view when you really think about it. I like it. This is to how to think of an infinitely small change in a function. Okay, as we have seen, Parmenides' insistence on the point that whatever is and cannot ever not be leads him to harshly critical of the ordinary run of mortals who rely on their senses, as supposing that things are generated and undergo all manner of changes. Okay, Parmenides directs us to judge reality by reason and not to trust our senses, which is good. This is sort of now makes sense. So he doesn't direct us, he has this goddess going bah, 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 bah. Parmenides directs us to judge reality by, okay, reason is as deployed in the intricate multi-stage deduction of fragment 8 reveals what attributes whatever is must possess. Whatever is must be ungenerated and imperishable, one continuous and indivisible, motionless and altogether unchanging, such as the past and future are meaningless for it. Which is rather curious because, I don't know, that's the thing of physics. This is, quote, all that can be said about what truly exists. And reality is thus revealed as something utterly different from the world in which each one of us supposes himself to live. A world in which nothing but the deceitful show. Parmenides nonetheless proceeds in the second part of his poem to present an elaborate cosmology along traditional lines, thus presenting readers with the following crux. Why should Parmenides take the trouble to narrate a detailed cosmogony when he has already proved that opposites can exist and there can be no cosmology because plurality and change are inadmissible conceptions? So how can you have a story if you've got no pages to write it on? On the practical ground that our senses continue to deceive us about its existence. Quote, his accounts of appearances will excel to those ours to ask. This is quote within a quote. But if it is unreal, what is the point of trying to give an account of it at all? Unquote. To put this question is put a question that is not likely to have occurred to him. Okay, so I don't know why these people want to criticize this bloke. He was just in the ancient world, just doing his thing, getting a bit confused, a bit bored, thought I'd write a poem, and a lot of people wrote about it. Okay, now, this is interesting. 3.2, the logic dialectical interpretation. Now, dialectical is a... determinism, I think it's Karl Marx. It's where you actually apply logic and live by logic, which is, I suppose. But 3.2 is another stream. So you've got the stream of strict monolithism. So you get a contradiction. Going up. One problem with Guthrie's view of Parmenides is that the supposition that Parmenides' strict monism was developed as a critical reductio of Malthusian material monism sits uncomfortably with the notion that he actually embraced this wildly counterintuitive metaphysical position. So, as a lot of these philosophers, he wasn't necessarily what we call, I won't say that, but he was self-evidently stupid position that nothing can move. but that sort of have stuck in there before the we got calculus and high level maths. Now I must admit I have just read what Malthusian was a monist, but Malthusian was a monist with the idea that opposites can be drawn out eventually. Okay. There is the same type of tension in the outmoded proposals that Parmenides was targeting certain supposedly Pythagorean doctrines, a view developed by Raven in 1948 and ensconced in Kirk and Raven in 1957. Good on ya, Raven. Well, yeah, Pythagoras was a philosopher further down the coast, and he is, well, he's definitely not the origin of monadism, but he drew the monad. Even as Guthrie was writing the first two volumes of his history, a shift was underway towards understanding Parmenides' arguments as driven by strictly logical considerations rather than any critical agenda with respect to the theories of the Ionian or Pythagorean predecessors. So Ionia also, I think, is their islands. I wish I could do it. I'll get on Google Maps and eventually look at it. There was a watershed event with the publication of G.E.L. Owen's Eclectic Questions. Owen, 1960. You thought the 60s were just full of rock and roll, free love, the Beatles, and, you know, President Kennedy, the Bay of Pigs, all that type of stuff, the moon race and all that type of stuff. No, it was the launch of Eclectic Questions. Owens found inspirations in Bertrand Russell for his positive interpretation of. So Bertrand Russell is this mathematician who began writing out philosophy in shorthand in maths. So you do it, and I actually find Bertrand Russell's set theory notation easier to understand than all this thick text. Parmenides' argument referred to the essential point of which Owen took to be that what can be taken or thought of about what exists. Okay, Russell's treatment of Parmenides in his History of Western Philosophy was conditioned by his own abiding concern with problems of analysis posed by negative existential statements. Now, the essence of Parmenides' arguments, according to Russell, is follows. And look, I have to agree, you can't debate. He just didn't have the maths as far as Russell was concerned. Let's hear what Russell has to say. Quoting the person. Now, you remember that Russell is a great man. I just think he's a fantastic chap. Pity few people have heard of him or know what he just done. When you think of something. When you use a name, it must be the name of something. Therefore, both thought and language require objects outside themselves. And since you can think of a thing or speak of it at one time as well as another, whatever can be thought or spoken must exist at all times. Consequently, there can be no change, since change consists of things coming into being or ceasing to be. That's Russell. However, Russell eventually pointed out the difference between set members and the set of a category. Here, the unargued identification of the subject of Parmenides' discourse as whatever can be thought or spoken of prefigures Owen's identification of it as whatever can be thought or talked about, with the proposals deriving from fragment 2.7 to 8. And what I was going to say is that my father, who is a theologian, often talked about this, tried to talk about, you know, is something an object or what's the name of it? There follows in Russell's history an exposition of problems involved in speaking meaningfully about currently non-existent subjects, such as George Washington or Hamlet, after which Russell restates the first stage of Parmenides' arguments as follows. If a word can be used significantly, it must mean something, not nothing, and therefore the word means must in some sense exist. And so influential was Russell's understanding being, thanks to no small part to Owen's careful development of it, that it is not uncommon for the problem of negative existential statements to be referred as Parmenides' paradox. And it's sort of like this is all over in a single, like, Russell, he's got pages of mathematical logical arguments. And this paradox is just one statement of it. And it's where you shift George Washington to the physical, to the existence. And it's really interesting that, we cover that in mathematical terms. So, for us, Newton with a capital N. Newton, I applied 10 newtons to the problem to push the car up the slope, means that I got 10, capital N means 10 actual physical newtons, whereas lowercase newton means the actual concept of newton. This is, you know, a newton force. Okay, Parmenides' paradox. The arguments of fragment 8 on this view are then understood as showing that what can be thought and talked about is, surprisingly, without variation in time and space, that is, absolutely one and unchanging. Which you actually need to do for your logical theory, because your logic could disappear, your logic could disappear by the time you got to the bottom of the page. Owen adapted an image from a Wittgenstein in characterizing these arguments, which ones which can, quote, can only show the vacuousness of temporal and spatial distinctions by a proof which employs them. End quote. As, quote, a ladder which must be thrown away when one has climbed it. It's interesting. Owen also vigorously opposed the assumption that Parmenides wrote his poem in the broad tradition of Ionian Italian cosmology, arguing that Parmenides claims no measure of truth or reliability for cosmology in the latter part of his poem, and that this, his own argument in truth, in the way of conviction, neither derives from the earlier tradition nor depicts the cosmos as a spherical shape. That's interesting. I picked that up. Does he? I sort of remember mentioning a ball somewhere. On Owen's reading, not so very differently from Guthrie's Parmenides' cosmology, is no more than a dialectical device, that is, the correct or the most plausible analysis of propositions on which ordinary men, not just theorists, seem to build their picture of the physical world. That is, dialectical materialism. It's rather than you just shut up and work, these allows your work of philosophers to come along, a la Marx. These being, quote, the existence of at least two irreducibly different things in a constant process of interaction. Whereas, Parmenides' own arguments have by this point shown both the plurality and the change this picture presupposes is unacceptable. Parmenides, there's been a hell of a lot of history happened in the 2,500 years since you stuck around. But, you poor bastard, no one really, if you had to care, I'd say that you'd have about 3 people in Australia, would know about 10 people in the US. You'd be troubled to fit a tour bus of people who know about you. Okay, possibly 2 tour buses if you really wanted to have hangers on, but you talk to people at the back of the bus and they'd be obviously have no idea, just coming along for the ride. Okay. Owen's view of Parmenidean metaphysics as driven by primarily logical concerns and his cosmology as no more than a dialectical device would have deep influence on 2 of the most important surveys of pre-Socratic thought since Guthrie. Jonathan Barnes' Pre-Socratic Philosophers, 1982 classic, and Kirk and Raven and Scherfel's Pre-Socratic Philosophers. Yep, they are exactly the same title by different authors. Okay, that would be a bit of a crap. But you can imagine you go to the library, they get it in for you, and you open the book, and I was hoping for a good Raven, but no, I got Barnes. Barnesy. While abandoning these birds are taking me here. While abandoning the idea of Parmenidean monism was a specific reaction to the theories of any of his predecessors, these two works continue to depict his impact on the later pre-Socratic system as decisive. On their own Owen line, the story becomes that the arguments of Parmenides and his Eleatic successors. So, Eleatic means from Ella. There you go. Eleatic. These are amazing successors. Were meant to be generally destructive of all previous cosmological theorizing insofar as they purported to show the existence of change, time, plurality cannot be naively presumed. Okay. So, I don't think Socratic actually got, as far as I could begin, it was more a methodology. I thought Socratic stuff, but Parmenides' arguments in Fragment 8 effectively become, for advocates of this line, a generalized but rather than a specific reducio of early cosmological theorizing. Barnes, furthermore, responded to an objection that had been raised against Owen's identification of Parmenides' subjects as whatever can be talked about and thought about, namely that this identification derives from reason gives at for rejecting for the second path of inquiry, whereas an audience could not be expected to understand this to be the goddess as a subject when she introduces the first two ways of inquiry in fragment 2.3 to 2.5. Okay, now, so you got to get to understand this goddess has said, look, up here, you want to hear what a goddess has to say? Well, here, I'm just going to chunder out philosophy for you, and you go, whoa, whoa, that's great, goddess. Hopefully the goddess will show you some other things, but no, she's doing philosophy, and she says, this monism means that you can't understand anything. Now, Barnes modified Owen's identification of Parmenides' subject so that it might be found in the immediate context, specifically in the implicit object of fragment 2.2's description of the paths of the way of inquiry. Thus, according to Barnes, the first path says that whatever we inquire into exists and cannot not exist. Of course, I think they're not really understanding what Russell was saying. Poor Russell. Barnes' modified Owen line has since endorsed by prominent interpreters including Scofield, Kirk, Raven, Scofield, and someone else called Brown in 1994, late Johnny Come Lately. Barnes also advanced the more heterodox approach that Parmenides was not necessarily a monist at all, arguing that the fragments are compatible with the existence of plurality, the Parmenidean beings. While this proposal has had fewer adherents amongst other interpreters. Favouring the Russell-Owen line, it has been taken up by certain advocates of the next type of interpretation. Okay, so, I don't know, these people, if you just read Russell, he says, which I have, just look over. It says that discussing a concept, you discuss a set, and it may have members or no members. Yeah. So the set of blue set of blue apples, that doesn't exist, but the set does exist. But it's got no members of it, and that was the end of the story, Russell. I don't know, I find this hard to swallow. 3.3, the meta-principle interpretation. One influential alternative to the interpretation of Parmenides as a strict monist, certainly amongst scholars working in America, has been developed by Alexander Bourlatos in his 1970s monograph, The Route to Parmenides. Oh, you'd think, oh my god, this is going to be an excellent travel book. 1970s. Love the 1970s. Read it. And this person here, but it sounds like, so this is actually quite good. See the Morillatus, 1979, for a succinct presentation of this alternative in response to perceived shortcomings of Owen's logical dialectical reading. Morillatus saw Parmenides as using a specialized predictative sense of the verb to be in speaking of what is, in a sense, used to reveal a thing's nature and essence. In this sense, the verb dubbed by Morillatus is the is of the nature and essence. The essence of the verb is of speculative prediction. It's supposed to be a feature statement of the form X is Y, where its predicate belongs essentially to or necessarily conditional for the subject, and thus gives X reality, essence, nature, or true constitution. Okay, well, I'm not impressed, my God, my friend. Alexander Nemas would likewise propose that Parmenides employs is in a very strong sense of is what is to be. So his concern is with the things which are symbol F in the strong sense of not being what it is to be F. Nemas, 1981. Though Nemas cites Owen as well as Bortaris as an influence, Owen himself took Parmenides' use of the word to be in what is as essential, existential, exists. On the resulting type of interpretation, the first major phrase of Parmenides' poem provides a higher order account into the fundamental entities of ontology, which is thought, knowledge structures, would have to be like. They would have to be F, capital letter F, for some F, in this especially strong way. As such, it could not account for what there is, namely one thing, the only one thing that exists, but rather of whatever is the matter required to be ontologically, fundamentally entity. A thing that is F, for some F, is an essential way. Thus, Nemas has more recently written, Nehemas. Yeah, I think what you can say is that this is sort of like people come up and they see a pile of rocks and people start debating, oh, it's a Barbie. No, it's a bike ramp. And you get people struggling and eventually they develop Barbies and bike ramps developed on it. So this is my stupid Aussie view of what's going on. So it's not so much important that he actually meant something, that all these people have interpreted and stuff has grown out of it. Okay, so this is Nehemis from the 1970s, is speaking to you thus. The signposts along the way to being, the way of being, which Parmenides describes in B8, whatever B8 stands for, may be taken as adverbs that characterize a particular and very restrictive way of being. The signposts then tell us what conditions must be met if a subject is to be something in an appropriate way, if it is really to be something and thus a real subject. And to be real, something F is to be F. B8 tells us, whatever B8 tells us, ungenerably and imperishably, wholly and only indivisibly, unchangingly perfect and completely. Parmenides was using being to express a very strong notion which Aristotle eventually was to capture in his concept of what it, now Aristotle, is to be. To say that something that is F is to say that F continues its nature. A variant of the metaphysical interpretation, one that also draws upon Barnes' suggestion that nothing in truth precludes there being a plurality of the Parmenidean beings, has been developed by Patricia Kerr. I was wondering when she was going to turn up. Patricia, what are you saying? On her view, Parmenides was not a strict monist, but rather a proponent of what she terms as predictational monism, which she defines as the claim that each thing can only be one thing. It can hold only one predicative and indicates what it is and must hold it in a particular way, strong way. To be a genuine entity, a thing must be predictational unity with a single account of what is, but it need not be the case that there exists only one such thing. Rather, the thing itself must be a unified whole. That is to say that if the letter F must be all and only and completely the letter F, on the predictational monism, a numerical plurality of one of such one beings, as well as we might call them, is possible. Curd from 1998, so she's still probably keying around. This is 20 years later. A bit of a head scratcher. She'd a bit of a surprising thing from her. Okay, let's go. Now she's in the crowd. Morelatos, Nehemus, and Curd all takes Parmenides to be concerned with specifying in an abstract way what is to be the nature of essence of a thing, rather than simply with specifying that there is in fact is, as he presumed to be doing both on the logical dialectic and the more traditional strict monist readings. Fair cop. I don't think he really understood. If you actually got him in the dock here, he'd just throw everybody out. I could well imagine him being, if there was a pot smoker at that stage. Since the principle reading takes Parmenides' major argument into fragment A to be programmatic instead of merely paradoxical or destructive, it suggests somewhat different narrative structure for the history of early Greek philosophy, one where the so-called post-Parmenidean plurus Epidoxals, Anaxagoras, and the early atomists Lacrosus and Democritus were not reacting against Parmenides, but were actually endorsing his requirements that what really is be ungenerated, imperishable, and absolutely changeless when they conceive the principles of their respective physical systems in these terms. The meta-principle reading has also seemed to reopen the possibility that Parmenides was engaged in a critical reflection upon the principles of its predecessors' physical systems. Yeah, I just think, if you've got absolutely zero science, it's also something like you get out of grade 6. This phrase, Parmenides' poem, provides... If the first phrase of Parmenides' poem provides a higher-order description of the features that must belong to any proper physical principle, then one would naturally expect the ensuing cosmology to deploy the principle that meets Parmenides' own requirements. The goddess describes this cosmology, however, as an account that account of the beliefs of mortals in which there is no genuine conviction, and commences this part of her revelation by describing how mortals have wandered astray by picking out two forms, light and night, to serve as the basis of the account of the cosmos' origin and operation. Actually, rather cluey. And they're saying, yeah, you know what? I just don't think it really stacks up. I think there's something massively deeper here. And this is shares with Bacon. This is Francis Bacon, a long time later. He is saying the future is going to be great. And it's essentially the future is going to be great. It's the sort of essential for any dude, sort of celebrity dude. I think Parmenides is a bit of a celebrity. Celebrity advocates of the meta principle reading here face a dilemma. Oh, blood oath. You didn't think you'd hit the dilemma. So they were saying that he's actually discussing not so much is, but the isiness of is. reading here face a dilemma. On one hand, they cannot possibly maintain that cosmology is what their overall interpretation would lead one to expect, namely Parmenides' effort developing a cosmology in accordance with his own strictures upon the principles of such an account must be like. The cosmological principles, light and night, do not, in fact, conform with those strictures, but then why should Parmenides have bothered to present a fundamentally flawed or near correct cosmology founded upon the principles that fail to satisfy the very requirements that he himself had supposedly specified? Gotcha. If one falls back on the position that this cosmology in the poem is not Parmenides' own, which remains implausible given the cosmology's innovations, then it comes even more puzzling why he should have described what principles are adequate cosmology must be like and then fail to try to represent one. So I really would like to know what Parmenides' cosmology was, you know, as it just snap it. Like, I really want to know what the, well, we know the Aboriginal cosmology, the Babylonian cosmology. I thought they said that this smacks of the I mean, he is the basic cosmology here going up to the night and day. Palace, I'm sure. This is him. The presence of a cosmology in Parmenides' poem continues to be a problematic for advocates of the metaphysical interpretation, just as it is for advocates of the other major types of interpretation discussed thus far. Guthrie views the cosmology of Parmenides' best attempt as Parmenides' best attempt of giving an account of the sensible world, given that we will continue to be deceived into thinking it exists despite his argument to the contrary. Not only is this an unstable interpretive position, it imputes confusion of Parmenides rather than acknowledges its own difficulties. It's hardly more satisfying to hold by Owens the Parmenides cosmology as has a purpose that is wholly dialectical. Though they repeat the essentials of Owen's view, Kirk, Rave, and Schofield finally acknowledge that the presence of elaborate cosmology remains problematic with this line of interpretation. Quote, why the cosmology has been included in the poem remains a mystery. The goddess seeks to save the phenomena so far as possible, but she knows and tells us that the project is impossible. Kirk, Rave, and Schofield, others echoing Owen's line of cosmology, dialectic character. While, I've got a theory, Parmenides had a ghost author. He didn't write his full poem. Someone else came in and wrote it. They had two authors. Okay, there you go. That would solve a lot of problems, wouldn't it? Well, the principal interpretation raises the... And so the second author didn't understand what he was saying. He was just too drunk. You can write it. And so this other person, you really believe in cosmology, said, you will not sell a poem with just logic. You've got to have sort of basics in it. You can imagine his manager saying it. Okay. While the metaphysical interpretation raises the expectation, which fails to be met, that the principles of Parmenides' cosmology will conform to the requirements he has supposedly specified earlier in the program, the strict, modest, and logical dialectical interpretations leave even some of their own advocates wondering why Parmenides devoted the bulk of his poem to an account of things his own reasoning is supposed to have shown not to exist. It's not to exist. You can't... Well, I don't think the word exist is what it is he's talking about. Is that existence is not what we think it is. So I'll stop there and we'll see how we can polish off this. This Parmenides, I didn't think it would be so long.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them and tell others. Thanks for listening.